Hi, it's Dave. Welcome. Today I'm joined by Eric Berger. He is the senior space editor at Ars Technica, also the author of Liftoff, a book about SpaceX's early days. I interviewed Eric for a fantastic interview several months ago about SpaceX. I'll go ahead and link to that episode, episode 310, in the video description below. I want to welcome Eric Berger back on the show. Welcome. How are you doing?
Hey, Dave. Great to talk to you.
Yeah, awesome. I'm excited to have you back. I have a funny story. So my we had Liftoff, and you know, my wife was reading it after I read it, and my six-year-old was like engrossed in the stories that my wife was telling, and he was dying for his own copy of Liftoff. So we had to get like another copy, and then my three-year-old wanted her own copy. So we've got multiple copies of your book. Fantastic job, though.
All right.
Yeah. So in this interview episode, I kind of want to do something a little different. I want to take a step back, and I want to give people an overview of kind of what SpaceX is trying to do over the next maybe 1 to 2 years. And I want to kind of pare it down into layman's terms so that we could kind of, anyone can understand, you know, what SpaceX is trying to do here. So we know that at Starbase in their Boca Chica, you know, base there, it seems like things are just at a frantic pace. You know, they're just whipping up these starships. They finally have the Super Heavy booster, and they put the starship on top. And we're talking about, you know, some orbital testing or some test flights coming up in the next couple of weeks, if possible. Can you give kind of like an overview of what's going on? Why does this matter in the kind of 1 to 2 year time frame? And what is SpaceX trying to do right now?
So, you know, for the last year and a half or so, SpaceX has been working toward testing the upper stage of a two-stage launch system. So the first stage is you know, the rocket itself with, you know, 29 or 33 engines, this massive vehicle that's basically designed to push the second stage, not quite into orbit, but send it on its way to orbit and basically get it above the Kármán line. And then the second stage ignites its engines and does the rest of the work in getting into orbit. And because Elon Musk viewed Starship, that second stage, as the most difficult part of the launch system, that's where he focused first, because he typically likes to dive into the most difficult problems first. And building a vehicle capable of coming back to Earth through the atmosphere at orbital velocities is, in his words, an insanely hard job. And so now that they were able to launch and land Starship from these 10 kilometer tests, the focus has somewhat shifted to Super Heavy, which is the first stage of the launch system. And that's not to say it's easy, because no one has ever successfully built a rocket, you know, with 29 or 33 first stage Raptor engines. These are very powerful engines. So the fact is, they've gone through some test versions of the booster, and now with booster number 4, they feel like they have a vehicle that they're ready to at least conduct a test flight with. So for the first time this last week, they rolled booster 4 out to the launch pad, and then a day or two later, they rolled so-called ship 20, number 20, serial number of their Starship prototypes, and stacked it on the booster for the first time. This was, I think, served two primary purposes for SpaceX. First of all, it was to do a fit check to make sure that everything lined up, and that when they went to get, you know, ready for a launch down the line, that this you know, they would fit. The second thing, I think, though, was to send a message. And that message was basically that, look, you know, we are almost ready to launch this thing. This is a real rocket. It's a real upper stage. And when we put the two together, it looks pretty fantastical. But it actually is real. And this is a problem because, you know, SpaceX has been working with the Federal Aviation Administration to get environmental approval to launch from South Texas. And that process has been moving pretty slowly. And so my sense is that this was a signal from Musk and from SpaceX that, hey, you know, we're just about ready. You know, we kind of need you guys to step up and be ready to.
Mm-hmm. From their Boca Chica site, their Starbase, how high can they launch right now without, you know, FAA approval?
They don't have approval from the FAA to launch Super Heavy. And really their next step, they don't want to really do hop tests with the booster because it's got so many engines. If you're going to risk sending it up to 10 meters, and they're not going to be able to land it. So there's no real reason to try to they're not going to be able to land it initially. So there's no real reason to do a hop test. The goal is to sort of demonstrate that you can get Starship to an orbital velocity. So they don't have permission for a super heavy launch yet. And so they can't launch it.
And I mean, how do you see this kind of situation playing out? Will SpaceX wait for that approval, do you think, or is there a chance they'll just go ahead and do it, or what's your take?
Elon Musk won't wait happily, but he will wait for approval from the FAA to launch this rocket. I mean, this, you know, if all goes well, this will be the first of many, many, many launches from South Texas. And you just don't want to step on the FAA's toes like that. I mean, they can literally shut you down. And, you know, if you mess with the FAA, that sends a terrible message to NASA, another federal agency, and it sends a terrible message to the Department of Defense that, you know, you're not willing to play by their rules. And let's be honest, the FAA has worked pretty well with SpaceX. You know, they are a bureaucratic agency, not accustomed to going fast, and SpaceX is a non-bureaucratic company that tries to go fast. So there is a real culture clash, and they are working on it. But these are complex issues. I mean, this is an unprecedented rocket. You know, when SpaceX came into South Texas about a decade ago, they said they were going to launch the Falcon 9, and that is a much smaller rocket than what is being presently conceived of. And so I think it's appropriate for an environmental review to be done. It's just taking a long time.
Got it. What are kind of the things that the FAA needs to go through, I mean, to actually get to approval, you know, for this, you know, Starship Super Heavy booster launch?
So I'm not an environmental lawyer, but my general understanding of the process is that right now SpaceX is basically drawing up a plan that assesses impact. So like what are the acoustical impacts? What, you know, what kind of sound, what kind of vibrations will this launch cost? And how can we ensure that the rocket is not going to go over a populated area and explode? And then SpaceX will design some mitigating procedures for that, you know, whether it puts up a sound wall or, you know, takes some effort for sound suppression. You know, I don't know the details of that, but they'll come up with a plan in concert with the FAA. And then the FAA will basically look at that and make it, and there'll be a public comment period on this environmental assessment.
Got it.
And then at that point, the FAA then will look at it and say, okay, well, we think this is good enough. You know, take these measures and we'll give you a launch license. Or they'll say, we need you to do more work, or we're going to need to do a much more in-depth review, in which case SpaceX would look for elsewhere to launch from.
Got it. I mean, if they have to do some type of public, you know, comments and all that stuff, are we talking about still months away before getting an approval, or is it completely in flux right now?
I think the public comment period probably would be about 30 days. And I think from a regulatory standpoint, SpaceX will be doing very well to launch this year. So I don't think we're looking at a launch in September or October. It would probably be later this year. And frankly, they've got a ways to go with the hardware as well. You know, a lot of the engines on that vehicle right now, there are 29 of them on the first stage. A lot of those are probably going to be swapped out for newer models of Raptor. So there's a ways to go. I mean, again, it was much more than a photo op what they did last Friday, but it was also clearly something of a photo op.
Yeah, that's interesting. So in the bigger picture, so let's say they get FAA approval by the end of the year, they successfully launch, you know, their first kind of integrated Starship. So Starship is not just the second stage, it's the whole rocket too, including Super Heavy booster, is that correct?
Right. Well, they've changed the naming quite a bit over time. It used to be ITS, Interplanetary Transport System. Before that, it was BFR, Big Frickin' Rocket. You know, then it became Starship, and now it's like the second stage is Starship, and they call it Ship. The first stage is Super Heavy; they call it Booster. You know, you could call it the Starship Launch System, but generically, Starship does refer to the whole thing.
Okay. So what's after? Kind of, let's say hypothetically, you know, they do a successful launch, how high are they going? Are they going to low Earth orbit at this time, or what's their plan, you think?
So the plan for the first launch is that the Super Heavy booster will go up, launch Starship, and then the Super Heavy rocket will land in the Gulf of Mexico. And then Starship will reach basically orbit, but it's the plan is not for it to make a full orbit. It's to actually come back and re-enter north of the Hawaiian Islands near Kauai, in which case they'll attempt to recover the Starship. So that's the initial launch, and maybe it'll be successful and maybe it won't.
Got it. So they recover it basically in the ocean, right?
Yes.
Okay. Got it. What's after that? Like, so let's play out this hypothetical, you know, FAA approval, successful launch by the end of the year. How does next year look like? How do you see the progression, you know, going in terms of testing and development?
So they'll have two primary objectives, I think, next year, both of which are hugely significant. The first one involves the booster. And the plan is to basically use the launch tower to catch it. There will be arms that extend from the tower. So now when we see a Super Heavy rocket come back, it basically comes back. But a Falcon 9 rocket comes and we see it land on a boat, right? And they come pretty close to the mark on those. So the idea with this is that there'll be some kind of telescoping arms on the launch tower. And the first stage rocket will come back and sort of slow down and hover, and those arms will extend out. And then basically using the grid fins, they will hold it, kind of capture it. So that seems crazy, right? For landing a rocket. And the idea would be that you could catch it and turn around in 24 hours again, launch again. So that's the vision. I think it's going to take some iterative steps to get there. So the first step, so with the booster, it'll be landing. And frankly, with Starship, the goal will be proving it can land as well, propulsively under its own power. And so, you know, it's going to be coming back from orbit at many multiples the speed of sound, just like the space shuttle. And if you think about the space shuttle, you know, it kind of had those tiles on its nose and these fragile tiles underneath its wings and its belly. And this was basically to withstand the atmospheric heating during reentry. Starship is going to be doing the same thing, only it's a much bigger vehicle. And it's not coming back to land on a runway. Basically, when the shuttle came back, it was a glider, right? So that the pilots had some control, but not much. Starship is, of course, going to be fully autonomous, and it's going to be firing its engines to slow down to the atmospheric entry and then sort of control, make it, you know, control burn. So their two goals will be to get to the point where they can recover booster and Starship, you know, next year. And I don't know if they'll get there. Elon has said, you know, that they probably will go through about 10 Starship prototypes in getting down the landing process. And so it's going to take time.
Got it. To clarify, so you got the booster kind of landing. They want to nail that. I guess first it would be landing on the ground and then eventually landing with these like two arms.
Maybe.
Right?
I don't know. They may not want to mess with landing legs. That may be like something that they don't really want to worry about. So they may go right toward tower landings and at some point it may just crash instead of, you know, them successfully grabbing it. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
And then the second, I guess, goal would be landing the actual Starship second stage down propulsively. What's after that? I mean, when do they start testing the whole orbital refueling, where they can actually, you know, refuel the second stage where multiple times to do a moon mission or a Mars mission?
Right. So as you say, Dave, you know, to actually do lunar missions or go to Mars, Starship, by the time it reaches orbit, will be its fuel tanks will largely be empty, and so you need to refuel it. And the number of refuelings you need to do for the Moon or Mars is roughly 6. Okay. And this is the scale of on-orbit propellant transfer. So the idea would be you'd launch another Starship, take some of its fuel, siphon it off, and pass it to the other Starship. Do it again and again. Again, this kind of on-orbit propellant transfer has never been attempted. And so it's a huge technical problem. And I think, you know, maybe they'll get started on that. Certainly they've been working theoretically on that with NASA for a couple of years. But that's a huge step. And so once they sort of get through the very early test phase with Starship, they'll start to put some Starlink satellites on there. as the first payloads that they launch, and then they may use some of those rockets for propellant transfer tests. But I would not expect to see that before maybe 2023.
Okay, got it. Interesting. Next year, let's say hypothetically, they're successful in landing, you know, the booster and Starship, and they got this down. What would be the next step in 2023? Would it be the orbital refueling, or is there something else that they could do in between?
No, I mean, that's a key thing they need to get down for their lunar lander contract with NASA. Mm-hmm. That's a big area of risk. And so I think they're going to want to get to buy down that risk as soon as possible. So in addition to, you know, we talked about putting the first payloads on Starship with the Starlink satellites, doing the orbital refueling, you know, I think the third thing that they're going to be working on is propulsively landing Starship in a moon-like environment, right? So one of the big questions is, you know, when we went to the moon in the Apollo program, we found that it's really a dusty place. The silicates there are pretty expensive. And so the question is, how do you land a Starship on the moon without creating a big crater, or because there's no landing pads on the moon, right? There's no drone ships waiting to catch your rocket. So if you're firing these engines right close to the ground, do they create a huge crater? Do they kick up all this dust that damages your vehicle and your engines? And so they're looking at a couple different ideas. And I think, first of all, they're going to get some lunar regolith-like material and put it down somewhere and start to do some landing tests with Starship to see what happens if you were to land that vehicle on the moon. Because another alternative is they may use some thrusters much higher up on the vehicle so that when they fired, you had much less impact on the lunar surface. But I think their preference would be to try to use the main Raptor engines for landing on the moon. And so that's another big test to look for.
Got it. What is kind of the big milestones for the whole NASA moon mission? If you kind of, you know, how long is this contract for? And then what are the kind of the big achievements or things that they're trying to go for with SpaceX?
Well, I think, you know, we've talked about a lot of them. The on-orbit refueling would be a big hurdle for them. Demonstrating landing on the moon. Ultimately, what they'll do there is they'll land a couple of Starships on the moon, probably without people, to see how that goes, to make sure they can safely put the vehicle down. And so those uncrewed tests will be a big thing. And another really big problem that they're going to have to tackle is actually, you know, life support on board Starship. Like, it's one thing to have a Starship act as like a, you know, glorified payload fairing and put a big satellite or, you know, hundreds of Starlink satellites, another to have all kinds of life support in there to keep astronauts going. I mean, if you think about Orion, which is this deep space vehicle that NASA has been working on in conjunction with Lockheed Martin, they have been literally building that vehicle since 2005. So, you know, crew is not going to go on that vehicle before 2023 in space. So that's 18 years. And now, you know, NASA or SpaceX got this contract from NASA for the human landing system in April, right? So getting life support on Starship is going to be a process. And SpaceX will want to go fast. NASA will want to be deliberative. And so it'll be a step-by-step process.
Got it. Is there any expectations you have on, like, when SpaceX might actually land, let's say, uncrewed, right, missions on the moon, and then also when they might land a manned mission to the moon?
Right. So I think, you know, depending on how well everything's a step, right? First of all, they've got to get it flying, and they've got to get the FAA approval, and then they've got to solve their technical problems, and then they've got to launch. And then they've got to figure out, you know, sort of launch and landing. And then once they get there, they can move to on-orbit refueling. And if that happens within the next couple of years, then they're going to be ready for some of these flight tests. And so I think 2023, 2024 is time to start landing Starships on the moon. And then, you know, if it depends the extent to which NASA really wants to push this, but, you know, you could see human landing attempts in 2026, some timeframe, probably. But the question is whether there's a congressional mandate to do how interested the White House is in pushing this forward. So under the Trump administration, there was a real urgency to land humans by 2024. Some of that was political, some of it was to keep NASA moving forward. We haven't seen that level of urgency from the Biden White House or from the Congress, you know, so we'll see. And that will drive some of the schedule as well.
Got it. Dear Moon, so we got a private funded kind of mission here to send people. Is it around the moon? And then do you think that's going to happen before, I guess, any human landing right on the moon? Is that kind of the idea?
Well, I think some of that will depend upon NASA's wishes. I don't know, you know, so NASA has its own, quote, Dear Moon mission called Artemis II. And that will be basically four astronauts getting in Orion, launching on a space launch system, flying around the moon and coming back. In concept, it's similar to Dear Moon. And I don't think NASA is going to want SpaceX to do that mission before NASA does. So there may be some interesting trades in the human landing system contract whereby NASA goes first with that and then SpaceX does Starship. I don't know politically quite how that's going to work out, but it's certainly something to watch. You know, as for the Dear Moon mission itself, again, given the constraints on propellant loading in orbit and needing to add life support equipment to Starship, you know, it's very difficult for me to see that happening before 2024, 2025.
Got it.
And even then it's pretty, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about Mars a bit. So we have some launch windows that are coming up. So I think September 2022 is the next one. And then a little bit more than 2 years after that, in 2024, and then in end of 2026. So 2022, September, is there any chance SpaceX can launch anything? Like, it sounds like Starship, it's not going to work out because they don't have their orbital refueling done yet. But can they do anything like with their Falcon 9 or send anything to Mars? Or is that, you think, out of the question? It's kind of pointless.
Yeah, they could certainly launch something. They could launch a small satellite with the Falcon 9, and they could launch a larger satellite with the Falcon Heavy. I don't think there's any real pressing need to do that. And I think Elon views those two rockets as dead-end technologies because as reusable as they are, the second stage is not reusable. And he just, even the day he launched the Falcon Heavy rocket back in 2018, he was all in on Starship. So unless NASA wanted a mission or something like that to Mars, there's just no reason I think SpaceX would do that.
Okay. How about 2024? Do you think SpaceX can launch an uncrewed mission? What do you think they would send to Mars, you know, if it's uncrewed? Would it just be like kind of lots of like vehicles to kind of scope out the planet? What else do you think, you know, they might be able to send?
So yeah, you're right. There's a window about every 26 months to Mars based upon the orbital dynamics of Earth and Mars. And so there would be a window toward the end of 2024 where they might, you know, look at launching something to Mars. And I don't know what they would send. You know, they don't really make payloads besides Starlink satellites. And so they wouldn't have anything to launch. And I don't know if they would want to try to land. There would be, see, if you go to Mars, there's all sorts of planetary protection issues that come up as well. So they would need to be real careful in that. And you know, I think they have a good chance at being ready to send some kind of payload to Mars in 2024. But maybe it's like some orbiting satellites for NASA. Because one of the biggest issues that NASA has right now is communications between Earth and Mars. The data relay satellites that we have there, basically you get data from the ground up to these satellites and then they send it back to Earth. That's really aging hardware. And so maybe they come up with some kind of deal where NASA uses them to launch communication satellites or other things. Maybe they'll try to land a Starship, but just... It seems, you know, seems difficult to me to imagine that given the planetary protection concerns.
Interesting. If, you know, they're launching these communication satellites, and, you know, is this something that you think that NASA would develop these satellites, or do you think they would just commission SpaceX to make these satellites? Because it looks like with, you know, Starlink, I mean, SpaceX is getting a lot of expertise with these type of communication satellites.
I don't know. I mean, you know... it might be some kind of commercial thing, because even now in 2021, you know, you're looking at about 3 years to prepare for this launch, and it takes quite a while to do that. So maybe NASA would go to some satellite company that's already making a satellite bus and say, look, we want to do some experimental communication satellites, you know, build us six to send to Mars in 2024. We're kind of late in the game for NASA to build like a classic spacecraft for this purpose, because that takes 5 to 7 years at least. But maybe, you know, they're all about buying services. So maybe they come to a deal where they pay SpaceX a little bit for a ride, they pay a company a little bit for development of these satellites, and then they buy time from these satellites when they reach orbit in Mars. I don't know. Honestly, yeah. I don't know how that would work.
Yeah, interesting. Chances of Elon Musk sending a Cybertruck to Mars in 2024. What do you think?
You know, I think he sent his Tesla once. Mm-hmm. I think he's probably, you know, I think he'd want to be a little more serious with the Starship going to Mars. You know, I think he did it once. I think he may want to shake it up. He's not going to send a wheel of cheese again. That's the planetary protection thing. So it may be something else.
Yeah, interesting. I wonder if he could like outfit a Cybertruck to be like a Mars explorer, you know, where it actually is like outfitted with everything it needs, you know, cameras and because it's got the whole like, you know, like 4x4 huge wheels go over the terrain. Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
The problem with that is I think the solar incidence you get on Mars is, you know, like a third of that on Earth. And so it would be, you know, challenging to recharge the power for
but
maybe you can buy a nuclear powered battery pack or something. I don't know.
Next generation pack. 2026 window, I guess Elon is probably hoping to send people to Mars, but realistically speaking, I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a challenge, right? I mean, to get everything ready by that time period. Is that how you're looking at it? Or how do you see the probabilities in terms of SpaceX actually sending people to Mars in 2026?
My probability for that would be about 1%.
Okay.
When I'm feeling optimistic. I think given all of the different challenges of sending people to Mars, and I'm thinking about political challenges. Again, planetary protection. Anytime you put humans into the loop of something like this, we are going to, in the words of scientists, contaminate the surface of Mars. We will we will lose the ability to tell whether, if we ever find life on Mars, whether it was, you know, from Mars or from Earth. And so that's a big deal. And that is going to be a fight that SpaceX has. And that's one reason why I think ultimately they end up working with NASA, because NASA can smooth that way for them. There's also the question of, you know, where do they live on Mars? Are they just going to stay in Starship? Are they going to have something to do? And then how are they going to come back? You know, we don't have any capacity right now to fuel those Starships and bring them back. And I think before you went to Mars, you'd want to be able to demonstrate you could launch from the surface of Mars. And so again, you know, all of that makes it seem very unlikely to me that you would launch in 2026, 2028. I mean, I would think early 2030s is the earliest reasonable time frame, and even then it would be absolutely moving mountains in a Herculean effort.
Huh, interesting. Is there any company out there that's even a close second place to what SpaceX is trying to do in terms of, you know, sending massive payloads to Mars and doing like a complete reusable, you know, orbital rocket system?
So the obvious answer might be Blue Origin, but the company I would say is called Relativity Space. They're based in Southern California. They're founded by Tim Ellis and Jordan Nunn, who worked in Blue Origin and SpaceX. And they have this vision of 3D printing almost the entirety of rockets. And their first rocket's called Terran 1, and it's supposed to launch at the end of this year for the first time. And then they're seeking to build an entirely reusable rocket. It's called Terran R. It's actually sized about like a Falcon 9, but it's basically a mini Starship. The first and second stage are fully reusable. And their long-term vision plan is to actually enable 3D printing on the surface of Mars. Like they want to go to Mars, 3D print rockets there, and be able to come back. And so after SpaceX, they're the company, I think, that has the most ambitious plan that involves Mars. And they're also like a real company. They have hundreds of employees. They raised more than $1 billion. And so they're definitely one to watch.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I love it when people like companies actually execute with real products, but have a different angle, you know, 3D printing is going to be interesting. I would love to talk with these guys at Relativity Space. That's the name, right, of the company?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. The CEO's name is Tim Ellis. Okay. Visionary guy. He's still in his 20s, I think.
Oh, wow. Crazy. Wow. Amazing. I'm wondering this past week, so Tim Dodd from Everyday Astronaut came up with, you know, this interview series with Elon Musk. Were you able to watch any of the parts this past week yet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Did you learn anything new? Was there any kind of relative or I would say relevant information that you thought was, you know, like, wow, this is something actually significant from the interviews?
No, I think it just underscores how many technical details there are involved in building this kind of a reusable launch system. I mean, you wouldn't think about it, but every millimeter of that rocket's design has been carefully considered and thought about and assessed for how much does it weigh? Could we make it weigh less? Aerodynamically, is this the best possible design? Could this part fail? And it's just an unbelievably complex process. And I thought Tim's video was good because he asked a lot of these technical questions. And it also underscores the fact that Elon knows what the heck he's talking about. I mean, he has been involved in a lot of those design decisions and for a lot of them made the final call.
Yeah. I mean, I was like impressed by how much technical knowledge, you know, Elon has on all the aspects of every single part of, you know, the whole rocket and rocket system. Most of it went over the head of, you know, of most people, including myself, just because of all the technical, you know, lingo there. But we got to see at least all this stuff, you know, up close, right, in production, like making it. I'm wondering, with Starship, one of the issues is if Starship is successful, it's going to bring down the cost of launch significantly, right? Maybe I'm hearing down to what, a couple million, maybe a few million dollars or so per launch. If that's the case, this is going to radically change the cost to orbit for satellites and SpaceX's launch mission. Wouldn't that, you think, lower their revenue actually, because it's such a dramatic, you know, or would they just increase their prices? It costs a couple million, but they charge, you know, more revenue because there is still that demand and there's no other, you know, cheaper option. What's your take kind of on this whole revenue side of SpaceX's launch business and the impact that Starship could have?
So that's a great question. And I think the answer is that SpaceX is already the lowest cost launch provider and will be for some time. And so there's no real incentive for them to reduce their costs. And therefore, they probably won't reduce their costs by that much. But ultimately, there will be more competition and we will see the price of launch come down. And I think what SpaceX is banking on, first of all, you know, the goal for Elon in this is not for SpaceX to become this fabulously wealthy company. The goal for him really was to build a transportation system that enables humanity to become a spacefaring species. I know that sounds like a cliche, sounds trite, but it's actually true. Like that is the goal of SpaceX, to make a science fiction like transportation system, which, you know, is difficult to imagine, but is now being built before our eyes. And so if he can bring the cost down to $2 or $3 million per launch, I think the idea would be that that opens up so much potential commerce in space that you can make plenty of revenue, you know, plenty of revenue there. Like, look at Starlink. Starlink does not happen unless you have a fully with a reusable Falcon 9 rocket, because if it costs you $60 million to launch, you know, 60 satellites, that's $1 million a satellite. But if you can do it internally for $15 million, that's $250,000 for satellite. So the economics change when it costs less to get to space. you can afford to do more in space. And so I think that's the idea, that launch should not be the end all and be all of costs. It should not be this huge gate. It should be sort of just this basic step. Like if you and I wanted to have a business meeting, you know, we don't have to build an aircraft to fly to one another. We can just go out and buy a ticket, right? The same kind of thing with launch. It should be a commodity. It shouldn't be sort of this grand, you know, grand expense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely makes sense. It seems like one of the possibilities is kind of like SpaceX takes advantage of their launch cost advantage, meaning like, for example, with Starlink, it's possible for them to get an advantage with this internet satellite constellation because their launch costs are so low. And it seems like they wouldn't allow a competing, let's say, internet, you know, satellite constellation to, or maybe they'll charge them, you know, like high rates or something. But it seems like because their costs are so low, they could use that to create a new business or a new, kind of a new opportunity. And it seems like Starlink possibly could just be the first one of those. Like, let's say looking out decades, you know, in the future, there could be other types of perhaps business opportunities that SpaceX, because they're the owner of the transportation system with the cheapest cost, they can maybe take advantage. Do you foresee any other type of business opportunities like that in the future besides like a Starlink?
Yeah, I think one that springs to mind would be space-based solar power. Would be enormously expensive to build this essentially farm of solar panels in space that would, you know, collect power above our atmosphere and then beam it back to planet Earth as a microwave. But there's endless room in space for this, right? We don't have to eat up real estate on the ground, and it's much more efficient because the sun is always on. It's guaranteed, right? You can keep the solar panels oriented to the sun at all times. It costs you, you know, $100 million to put a panel in geostationary space or wherever you decide, L2 or wherever you decided to put this farm, or if it costs you $10 million. I mean, again, the economics of this change dramatically when you lower the cost of access to space. So space-based solar power would be one, you know, or you could, you know, I think the, you know, biggest long-term one is orbital mining, right? Getting materials from the moon, but probably especially from asteroids so that we don't have to strip mine Earth for these rare earth metals. So I think in the nearer term, probably space-based solar power, and then a little bit longer term would be asteroid mining.
Yeah. I did get a question from one of my Twitter followers. David Dale says, in what order does asteroid mining come in? First, after the moon, after Mars? Is it even doable with Starship? Doesn't SpaceX have to be able to, like, be able to get to the asteroid and then, from the asteroid, that's like a whole nother step to try to mine the asteroid? I mean, it seems like a pretty daunting task. I mean, I'm just curious, like, what's your take? Where are the closest asteroids that they can actually mine? And what time period do you think that might happen?
Right. So there are near Earth asteroids. And for a time, NASA had a mission called the Asteroid Retrieval Mission, or ARM, where they were going to try to go to one of these near Earth asteroids, grab a small chunk of it, and then bring it back to the moon. That didn't happen. It got canceled, probably for good reasons. But there are some near-Earth asteroids you could get into, but still it's a long way to get there. It's not like going to the moon. The moon will be first, right? And then I think it's a question of whether we do Mars or asteroid mining first. I think Mars probably happens. But there are a couple companies like out there trying to develop asteroid mining techniques and so forth. But the problem, as you say, is that they're very far away generally. You know, think about the asteroid belt that's beyond Mars.
Yeah. Why would the original plan for NASA like bring it back to the moon versus bring it back to the Earth first?
So it's complicated. It's political. But basically, President Obama came in and canceled Constellation in 2010, which was NASA's plan to go back to the moon. It was way behind budget. It was behind schedule and so forth. But he didn't want to do another moon plan. His comment was, been there, done that. So they couldn't really go to Mars. And so the idea initially was to send a crew to a near-Earth asteroid. But then they realized there's no way they could actually do that because this was like a year-long mission, blah, blah, blah. And so then they were going to bring a chunk of an asteroid back to the moon and then have astronauts visit it near the moon. And so then they would still be visiting an astronaut, technically meeting what the president had called for. But then this was canceled by the Trump administration in favor of Artemis and just going back to the moon. Mm,
got it. Interesting. Do you know offhand, like, how far these near-Earth asteroids are?
Well, it depends. I mean, you know, some of them get fairly close to Earth, right? Because obviously we talk about potential asteroid collisions from time to time. And so the idea was you'd have to find one and then get up all this velocity to try to match it and then be able to turn around and come back to Earth. And that was just a really daunting challenge for a number of reasons.
Interesting. I've noticed just the past few months, like, it seems like Elon Musk is getting really into, what's going on with SpaceX, because I mean, there seems to be different times where he gets really focused on different things. And it seems like Starship and what's going on in Boca Chica is a big kind of thing right now. Do you think this is just kind of like a phase where then it kind of will shift to other things in his life and other companies at with different developments? Or do you think this signifies a longer term kind of shift where the momentum doesn't really slow down, because as you're saying, hey, they've got all these different milestones and the stakes get higher and higher and, you know, they're getting closer and closer to Mars. So do you think this could signify some type of, you know, mental shift in terms of priority for Elon Musk? Not necessarily he'll ignore his other stuff, but that, you know, he's getting, I guess, I mean, he's always been hands-on, obviously, you know, with SpaceX and everything. But I mean, I'm just curious, do you notice anything in terms of kind of priority or focus or attention shift with Elon Musk?
Well, I think it's very significant that since 2019, second half of 2019, he has been spending an enormous amount of time in South Texas at Boca Chica. And you know, in 2020, I think he spent more time there than anywhere else. He was living there several days a week. He's obviously moved to Texas, and that's in part to be closer to Starship. And so I think that is his main priority. You know, he just turned 50. I think he realizes, you know, he has a finite amount of time on Earth, and SpaceX, which was founded in 2002, has come an awful long way in 19 years. But to reach their goals, they've got a long, long way to go. So I think he's, you're right. I mean, there's been periods in the past where he's been focused on SpaceX or Tesla. And I think maybe he views Tesla as more of a maturing business. Like they've gotten a lot of the issues of production behind them. And while Tesla is still doing lots of cool new things, it's kind of new models of vehicles. Whereas from a technical standpoint, you know, Starship still has so much to go to become a reality. And you know, it's very promising early on, but it could still easily fail for a number of reasons. So I think until the conveyor belt exists between Earth and Mars, which is probably 15 years, something like that, very rough guess, he'll be focused primarily on SpaceX, because he views that as one of the grand challenges of his life.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Starlink IPO. So, you know, Elon has mentioned that, you know, they're kind of waiting for Starlink to have more consistent revenue. How important do you think it is going to be for, you know, SpaceX to IPO Starlink? Have you thought about maybe how the ownership mechanism works? Does SpaceX IPO it, but then keep, you know, most of the ownership and slowly just sell shares over time to fund SpaceX? Is that kind of the idea you imagine, or do you see any other type of construct there?
I think it would be probably the mechanism by which they raise the capital needed to build a fleet of Starship vehicles once they get the development problem solved. And I don't know how they would do it. I suspect you're right. They would keep a majority ownership and sell shares over time as they need to raise funds. I do know they must be licking their lips, because in the space industry over the last 18 months or so, we've seen all these special purpose acquisition companies or SPACs come in, and some companies with really questionable finances have had valuations of more than $1 billion. So if SpaceX can get to the point where Starlink is generating significant revenue and they're very far ahead of OneWeb, Telesat, Amazon's Project Kuiper in terms of satellite internet, and because it has the SpaceX brand attached, I mean, they could easily raise, you know, billions and billions of dollars to propel space forward. And especially like the idea of owning a piece of SpaceX, even if it's only the Starlink part, mm-hmm. I think would be hugely attractive to investors.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely agree. With Starlink, I've been thinking about kind of this idea of the first mover advantage. I mean, some industries, you know, you might not really have a first mover advantage. The first mover just proves out the market. Later players like, let's say, Google come in and, you know, with search, take over the market. But with satellites and with SpaceX, I was just thinking the other day that there could be this first mover advantage if you can set up a satellite constellation like Starlink. And I think that right now they have like, what, about 1,700 satellites or so. And if you can actually get it working and get it the costs down to where people can afford it, and you get, you know, several million people, for the next player to cut into that space and actually gain millions of followers, they need to compete with your system out there. And they need to either beat your system with price or performance. But how can you beat it with performance if you don't have the satellite system, right? And so to beat it with price, you have to subsidize it. But you have to subsidize it for quite a long time before, you know, like you can match, let's say, a Starlink's performance. So it seems like, you know, it's going to be a daunting challenge for, you know, whether it's Project Kuiper or others, you know, to be able to compete against SpaceX. But on the flip side, you have Jeff Bezos with his, you know, deep pockets. He can fund this stuff and really, you know, has a long-term vision. What's your take in terms of Starlink competition in the future?
So it's really interesting. The only other satellite internet, low Earth satellite internet company out there that actually is flying satellites is OneWeb. And they kind of illustrate the challenge of a company competing against SpaceX because they're having to launch all their satellites on Soyuz rockets. They're buying, through the Europeans, they're buying rides on Russian rockets to get to space. And that's obviously a lot more expensive than just, you know, launching on your own rocket that's fully reusable. And they're not seeking, I think at one point they did, but they are not seeking to become like a Comcast internet provider. Their sole focus is on enterprise and government customers. So like, I think where they're really hoping to make their money is by selling to national defense agencies. So like it would be, you know, providing more real-time data for, you know, the military, like with things like missile defense and services like that. And so they're not focused at all on consumers. I think partly that's a response to the fact that SpaceX has had, you know, in my mind, the main challenger really is Project Kuiper for the reason you cited, the fact that Bezos could invest billions of dollars to keep that system afloat. Mm-hmm. But they're, you know, they're having significant challenges because Bezos's rocket company, Blue Origin, isn't ready to launch those satellites. So they recently had to do a deal with United Launch Alliance, another U.S. company, to launch their satellites. Again, these are rockets that are completely expendable, and so you're just, it's costing you a lot more to get your satellites into space, and they're 3 to 4 years behind. The Project Kuiper hasn't launched a single satellite, and I think the Tintin satellites went up when, in 2019 or something like that, for SpaceX. And so, you know, they're far behind in terms of both being a first mover, and it's also going to be a much more expensive proposition.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me because in some ways it would, like, financially wise, it would make sense for Elon to wait until Starship is up and going to put all these, you know, Starlink satellites on there. But he didn't do that. He actually started, you know, before that. And I wonder if he kind of understood that there is a important first mover advantage, not just with the number of satellites you get up there early and the customers, the momentum, but also with the whole regulations and the whole, you know, satellite applications, this whole process that involves the government too, where you don't want to wait maybe too long, you know, where you allow other competitors to kind of be at the same place as you. So I don't know, it's an interesting strategic move, it seems like, where Elon actually said, hey, I'm going to not wait. We're going to put out satellites as fast as possible and get something up, at least, you know, running. What are your thoughts with that?
I think that when he first committed to Starlink, he wasn't sure how well Starship development was going to go and how much private money he would need to support the project. And so I suspect his feeling was, well, let's get going on Starlink as soon as possible and point where we're generating revenue so that we can support Starship. And it was really pretty wild that he was taking on, SpaceX was taking on these two incredibly capital intensive projects. On one hand, you had Starship development. On the other hand, you had Starlink, and both were just, you had to spend billions and billions of dollars up front to get up and running. But I think he did that because he wasn't sure how well Starship was going to go. And he didn't certainly realize that NASA was going to step up and be interested in using it as a human landing system. Financially now, like, he probably doesn't need Starlink so much anymore for Starship, but they're both sort of in full swing. And so he's just, you know, he doesn't slow down. He tries to accelerate forward.
Yeah, definitely. Recently, over the weekend, we learned that SpaceX acquired Swarm Technologies. Do you know anything about their kind of their microsatellites and what they're trying to do? And do you know anything?
No, like, I still don't. I'm still not sure what that was for. I'm sure it was either for IP or for some kind of technology. They had people or ideas that they wanted. It's interesting because they don't generally acquire companies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. Fascinating conversation. For people who are trying to like get up to date and kind of, you know, keep up to date with SpaceX. Can you share some resources, some sites, some channels or things that you kind of follow that might help others as well?
Well, I mean, the best official source of information for SpaceX these days is Elon Musk on Twitter, because he is often commenting or posting or replying to people and providing much more information than the company officially does. And that's how he likes it. I mean, he prefers to be the official sort of source of information for SpaceX. There are some phenomenal resources for what's happening in Boca Chica, probably the best of which is NASASpaceflight.com. They have a YouTube channel where they do weekly videos where they update what has been going on, or sometimes daily. And that's an incredible resource as well of information about what they've captured on camera, what they're hearing from people kind of on background, and sort of the official information out there. And so that's a good video resource as well to keep up on it.
Awesome. Great. Thanks, Eric. And then people can, I'll go ahead and link to your Twitter, just profile in the video description, a link to Ars Technica, to your Liftoff book. Is there any other places where people can find you and what you do?
No, that's perfect.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you. Yeah. I love your work, what you're doing. And I love how you're able to kind of just crystallize and make kind of bring down to earth, like, some of the stuff that SpaceX is trying to do. Super awesome. Fascinating. I think, and for me, it's like what SpaceX is doing is like, it's still like there seems to be this growing fan base, right, of really SpaceX enthusiasts. And I mean, some of these like SpaceX YouTube channels are getting actually a lot of views, and it's just, there's a growing kind of horde of these people really into it. But I think in the bigger kind of cultural type of understanding, most people, they don't really get like what SpaceX is really trying to do. And if like the technology and the ambition, the scale of, you know, what's going on. And, but I think it's fascinating.
No concept whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. And when you look back at the bigger picture of, you know, if we look back 50 years from now or something, you know, it's like this stuff is going to be historical, like all, you know, how humanity was able to create, you know, a system, a transport system to get off of Earth, you know, and spawn a whole, not just new economy, but another basically civilization. You know, that's the goal and the host. But
I agree. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to be watching it in real time.
Yeah. Awesome, man. Thanks, Eric, again. And hope to touch bases again soon.
All right, anytime, Dave. Okay. Appreciate it.
Bye.